This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back to another hour of Radio 314. This is going to be an interesting program, and it's something that we can all try and test for ourselves. We're going to hear about reverse speech and how it can be used to find hidden messages in the human voice. Messages that can be very helpful to unlock your unconscious insight from deep within. Joining me is John Kelly, an international clinician and world-famous speech analyst who released key intelligence pertaining to the Iraq War 2 years in advance of the shock and awe strikes against Baghdad in 2003. As a former feature producer for CBS Radio, his work exploring consciousness, communications, the paranormal, and UFO phenomena have been featured in numerous mainstream and alternative media outlets. Hello, John. Welcome. How are you this evening?
Terrific. Thank you.
Well, as one of the world's most sought-after practitioners in the field of discovering and interpreting secret backward messages in the human voice, where did this practice begin for you?
I became aware of these studies through RPL's 1990s broadcasts, and I pursued studies in a post-secondary vocational institute in Southern California with the people who had been researching this for some decades prior to my getting involved. And I saw something that was applicable for people, particularly people who were looking for resources in aid of healing and wellness, people who had been in long-term talk therapy and may have hit some kind of obstacle or ceiling in their growth and progress. This appeared to be a short-term intervention that would help people and to forge a strong connection with their own inner feelings, inner sensing, and their inner voice. And so I took a great interest in a procedure that appeared to offer a short-term intervention to help large communities of individuals. People are suffering in Western society from adverse impacts of institutions like the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts. Even in our universities, there are severe behavioral issues between young people and adults. So the survivors of those conflicts are in our society now, and they're looking for resources. This tool, these speech studies, these non-intrusive speech studies, are certainly a very powerful tool to help people looking for wellness and healing resources today.
So, what are the origins of reverse speech research? Who first started doing it?
Well, I think that from the conversations I've had with numerous sound engineers, it was the people who were enabled with the tools and equipment that allowed them to do editing functions and filters, filtering sound, mirror filtering, backwards filtering. It would be those individuals. So there's a lot of unsung people in production who were first exposed to the phenomena or were first able to make these kinds of observations or to resolve communications hidden in backwards speech. Mm-hmm. The subject was popularized through the appearance of David John Oates, an Australian, in the American scene, and he became a very popular guest with Art Bell, and it was through those interviews that I became aware of the subject.
Okay. Well, I think we should begin with maybe some reference points in culture and history of reversing speech, or as you like to say, mirroring ourselves.
Well, the mirror is a very ancient tool. And was used, there's literary sources that talk about how the Greeks were using it, for mystical practices related to grieving and the departure of loved ones. That was written about by one of those professional scientists, the fellow who wrote Life After Life. I'm sorry, the name escapes me, but Life After Life is a famous book about reincarnation, written by an academic. And in that book, he mentioned this Greek concept of contact with other dimensional entities via a mirror surface. And in that case, I believe they were using reflective ponds. So when we think about our Stone Age ancestors and their encounters with reflective surfaces, such as bodies of water, the archetypal or symbolic implications of seeing oneself and of course, what's behind us via the mirror, you know, the mirror that we use in the rearview mirror in our cars, the implications philosophically indicate that it could be possible to see, in fact, where we had come from. If we could see behind us, you see, the road behind us where we had crossed, we could see that path from whence we had come. And this is an important metaphysical concept because it relates to ideas of a point of origin of consciousness. So as archetype, I say that the early primitive Stone Age people, through their encounter with reflective phenomena, were awakening archetypes of access to a point of origin. In philosophies such as yoga or tantra, there are ideas related to a return to a mystical point of origin and a cosmic contact resulting in a nirvana or a samadhi, a blissful state. So it's a very important idea. And our ancient ancestors in the Stone Age were making contact with reflective surfaces, and that these archetypes were awakening within them. In later, more advanced civilizations, such as the Greeks, they retained this magic mirror principle philosophically, and there are expressions of that application and use to contact the dearly departed loved ones. Western folklore has retained the conception of the magic mirror, and we find it expressed in literary traditions such as children's fairy tales, Snow White, for example, and the recitation of Mirror, Mirror on the Wall. So people were, in our folkloric Western tradition, people were making use of mirrors. But it was when the scientific revolution, of course, came that mirrors really came into play, when we started to use them in reflector telescopes. And in fact, today, the majority of the large installation reflector telescopes in use now, the largest installations and the majority of them are all reflector-based. The largest telescope systems used by science. Science and engineering recognize the powers of reflective surfaces in resolving answers to questions related to cosmic origins. But in this case, of course, we're making indirect studies of the light from distant stars and other bodies as they are resolved on our eyes through impact with these mirrored surfaces on those telescopes. So the use of a mirror to resolve all kinds of complicated questions and to make assertions even about the nature of the universe is common practice in science. And so we are now, in this study that I conduct, we are now utilizing a mirror filtering and applied to speech signals, which of course are part of our electromagnetic spectrum. They fit into the sound, audio waveform category. We're just using mirror filtering. But it is through the study of these reflections that we are resolving the archetypes of the unconscious. And so it's a very interesting idea. And simplified, when we think again about this idea of reflection, in metaphysical terms, it means meditation, in a quest for self-knowledge. Through an act of reflection, we engage with the unconscious. And so this practice complies, you know, with that simple concept and principle. We're reflecting the speech signal in an attempt to understand unconscious processes taking place within human beings who are talking and communicating that way.
I was reading the other day that some reverse speech analysts believe that the two-edged sword spoken about in the Bible refers to speech, both forwards and backwards. And also, the Bible also refers to the voice of the Spirit as being under the tongue. So maybe this is a reference to reverse speech.
That's a very interesting point. I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm sure that people who study that work could identify with what you're saying.
And then thinking of another place, Aleister Crowley, of course, he taught the law of reversal, which is apparently the crux of Satanism, right? They perform everything in reverse and read backwards or in reverse speech. So a lot of times Christians think when they hear reverse speech, they think, oh no, it's satanic.
Well, I think that people may be naive about concepts related to encryption. You know, the term encryption etymologically relates to concepts of entombment or burying, like burying the dead. Mm-hmm. In a crypt. So when we use that language today to discuss coding and encoding and decoding, which is essentially the function that is being performed here, we're decoding. The message is encoded backwards in human speech. The cipher is the mirror. We're decrypting or raising the dead from a metaphysical point of view. So concepts of death and life and encodement are tied linguistically together. Whether or not that relates to everything that you had just mentioned, I'm not sure, but there's concepts of du soleil dancing in Western Europe from folkloric and pagan traditions. Du soleil means against the sun, and the sun being the one of the original clocks used to measure the passage of time. So against movement against time, so to speak, has implications. It has implications in Tantra Yoga, for example, where counterclockwise rotation is considered the descriptive of the movement or the of the ascending kundalini.
Mm-hmm.
So the concepts of movement against time and their implications for metaphysical insight are universal. And so when I say that the timeline stops at the mirror in this study, it's like that Stone Age person accounting their reflection for the first time. Time stops, and their perception temporarily transports them to the concepts of the point of origin, where I came from, as in, where did I come from? Who am I?
So do you think entire reversed conversations are taking place all the time when we speak?
No, because in my studies, the messages, the transmission is not contiguous, which means that there are pauses between transmissions. And compared to data signaling, we could compare this to what's called burst transmission, which means that over certain periods of time, there were highly intense moments of verbose expression, and then those are separated by longer periods of simple noise that's unintelligible and unresolvable.
So when picking out a genuine speech reversal, instead of trying to force together a phrase from gibberish, it should be very obvious when you hear it back, right?
Well, in fact, my experience as an active listener is simply that the messages announce themselves to me. I identify them. I resolve them as they pronounce themselves against the backwards noise. So it is not, there's not been great hardship in achieving those resolutions, but there is a certain commitment of time involved because, as I said, if it's only burst transmission, it's not contiguous. You have to wait a certain period of time, perhaps, under those conditions before each message made its appearance. And that would then bring into questions related to individual stamina, like how many people can actually sit through long, prolonged periods of listening to backwards audio. It is a very kind of unusual stimulus, to say the least, and it has various effects on the mind of the observer during those long listening processes.
Hmm. So what are Freudian slips then?
Well, a Freudian slip is just accidental communications, and they were identified, I believe Freud talked about it, unconscious behavior in speech communications. When we don't intend to say something and we do, it's considered this form of accidental speech, but it's not volitional on the part of the speaker. It's involuntary.
But is it something that we actually want to say? We're just holding back?
Well, it would seem as if there were a part of us that wanted to talk about it because it did, the slip is an event. It's, and again, I guess it's not a hypothetical. We only comment on it after it happened. So if we could assume that there was some form of involuntary volition, but not conscious volition.
It's kind of like the muscular movements we make when we speak. It just kind of happens sometimes.
Well, I think the most important comparison that I could make to these phenomena is what's known as sleep talking. Do you know anyone who talks in their sleep?
Well, I do.
Well, those motions are involuntary as well and unconscious, because although if someone were to observe you while you were practicing that, they would be able to hear you making speech sounds, but they would recognize that due to the fact that you were asleep, that it was not conscious behavior on your part. And therefore, I say that we understand that there's such thing as unconscious speech behavior, and that the hidden messages in human speech that are hidden backwards within human speech are also unconscious in their origins.
Hmm. So is reverse speech used to subliminally send messages, perhaps?
Well, these messaging transmissions can be detected through periods of observation. And so we claim that transmissions occur. Yes, there are such things.
Now, do you think that words also carry power with them? Are we creating when we hear them or speak them, whether forwards or backwards?
Are we creating? Well, I guess there's two questions in that. Are we creating, and do words have powers of their own?
Mm-hmm.
So to answer the second question, in yoga practice, there are concepts related to sounds that are calibrated to decrypt, cosmic constructs that reside within the human body. And so when people recite a mantra, during a yoga meditation. There's this understanding that if they work with that sound, somehow there's something key about that sound that will activate something within them. So those words are considered to have powers, but particularly in that context, the words, the powers of the words are an attribute granted by the chief instructor, which would be a guru. So the guru's blessing gives the mantra, it's imbues the mantra with a special vibration that activates higher consciousness in the practitioner. So under those conditions, I understand that. Are we creating? Yes, I think people are very creative. People are creating things all the time.
No, I think we should talk about a few of your landmark discoveries you've made public. Can you tell us about a few?
Well, I was able to expose factual information pertaining to the Iraq War 2 years before it began through numerous appearances on broadcast radio. And it was my observation that President Bush, during his inaugural address, gave utterance to a remark referring to a mission of Baghdad, and that the pastor who spoke after him to give a benediction commented on a missile attack in an unconscious way. And so when I paired these two pieces of data together, I saw a picture related to what would eventually become the shock and awe strikes that initiated the war against Iraq, which was something like a dozen years, 10 years long. So I picked up on military grade intelligence, and I can say that it was military grade because the level of precision was very high. It described the target by geographic name, and it described the military strategy, which was cruise missile strikes. That was at the beginning of the Iraq War. So that's military grade intelligence, and it's a matter of public record that I issued all those reports. I have date stamped air check tapes from the radio station. For example, where I first gave that broadcast the Monday after the inaugural address, and the cassette has the station logo on it, the letterhead, and the show that I gave that broadcast on is still on the air. So any curious person could simply contact them and ask them to check their logs to see if that broadcast occurred. I gave a series of broadcasts like this, they were alike in the sense that I shared what turned out to be predictive materials with the public before events occurred. And so when I was asked to appear in Wichita, Kansas on morning radio about 10 years ago or so, there was a case going on in the region related to a notorious criminal called the BTK Killer, who had been active in Wichita in the 1970s. And during that period of time, he used to taunt police and local journalists with letters saying how they would never be able to catch him. And in those letters, he also detailed the crimes in such a way that the police recognized that only a person who would be on the scene would know those details. So the police authenticated the letters and said, these are from the real killer, although they hadn't caught him. By the time I became aware of the story, there had been more deaths in the 1990s, and then the police in town had arrested someone on suspicion, and they had them in the local county jail. And so this individual gave an interview to local television, and I studied that interview, and he was just talking about bureaucratic paperwork and preparing for a hearing before a judge. But I heard more information, and what I detected was an issue related to spirit possession and demonic possession. Mm. The demons influenced that guy, is what I heard. And I thought that was really, really strange and odd, because I had a number of years of clinical work behind me already, and I wasn't coming across a lot of messages pertaining to the subject. So I thought this was really unusual. There I began my research of this individual and of the BTK case to look deeper to see if there were any strange tangents to this story that had to do with demonic possession, the occult, etc. Well, this is where it took me back to these letters that BTK had written. Because in those letters, not only were there details of the crimes that authenticated them as being written by the original killer, but there were claims pertaining to demonic possession. Mm-hmm. And so the parallelism of the letters of BTK and these unconscious utterances of Dennis Rader, who was being held in the jail, were striking to me. And so I went on the air on Wichita Morning Radio 15 minutes before Dennis Rader's hearing, before a judge, and I gave my report, IDing him as the killer based on that evidence. And at 7 o'clock that morning, Dennis Rader made his appearance before the judge and for more than 1 hour gave a chilling confession to all of the BTK crimes.
Wow.
So I was IDing him on the air in his hometown where the story happened 15 minutes before he gave this shocking and graphic confession to all of the BTK crimes. So this is forensic grade intelligence now. We have military grade intelligence, forensic grade intelligence. We also have medical grade intelligence emerging from this work, and that the applications are in the personal counseling that I do by telephone. And so as a short-term intervention, this work is by helping people to bypass very, very long processes, long protracted, drawn-out processes of discovery in conventional talk therapies. We're intervening because we only require short speech samples to detect unconscious behavior. And when we can create a feedback loop wherein the participants encounter their own unconscious speech and hear it for themselves, it can promote tremendous cathartic responses. So there are claims about the private sessions wherein people say they'd been in psychiatric counseling for 7 years every week, and that we had covered all the ground that 7 years of psychiatric counseling had covered in one session.
Mm.
So people are making such claims, and I've been practicing this counseling application for more than a dozen years. So really, I saw value in this work that could be realized at a grassroots level, that to helping people in communities to reaccess and discover resources for creativity and wellness, and that when our society became populated by healthy people, I knew that we would be taking steps towards creating a better society. So I was very inspired, and I remain inspired by the quality of the work that comes out of the telephone sessions, as well as the valuable intelligence that can be derived from applying these studies to the speech of important political figures or otherwise.
Do you think we can use this practice to find out anything we want to know, or are there limits, you think?
Well, like everything in this world, I think there are limits. An example of that would be sometimes people become very enthusiastic about participating in private sessions and they want to book more than one session per week. And what we discover is after two or three sessions that are closely booked together, that the repository of messages that person is able to communicate dwindles. And we'll even find material that says, and I'm paraphrasing, there's no messages today, you know, come back next week. The unconscious speaker doesn't want to be harangued, you know, and with demands. There are natural processes. When we plant a seed in the ground, we want to, you know, water it, put some earth over it, and then we want to just leave it alone to do its thing. When we intervene in people's most intimate personal issues, we also want to touch them in a way that is creating a lingering, disturbance as a result of those interventions. So it's important to understand longer term processes than to necessarily attach, need everything to happen at once. I mean, there's a reason why we have such a thing as time. I'm compressing the timeline to get to, shortcuts to information, mm-hmm. but there are also real reasons why we have such a thing as time. So we can't cheat time in an ultimate sense, but this isn't cheating. It's decryption. The messages are encoded in our speech, and the mirror is the tool that we use to decode them.
Yeah, it also seems that our higher self or unconscious self, it will speak when we really need to hear something. But if we're doing all right, maybe it's not going to be as loud.
Well, yeah. So these are questions that remain for further studies. In terms of volume, frequency of transmission, these kinds of questions. But in practice, we can engage the unconscious speaker. That's good news. And the unconscious speaker wants to talk to us. that inner voice wants to be heard, and there are different benefits to engaging that. But at the same time, you know, there's transformational processes that can be evoked from that. Change, in other words, may be scary. You know, the prospect of actually changing, instead of just complaining about this problem that I've had for the last 5 years, now I'm going to become someone different. What? I'm all in attachment, you know, to my issue and identifying with that. So you see all these different challenges, the people we naturally want to grow and develop, but at the same time, all these inhibitors that we're wrestling with. And so for people to make progress, you know, it's it needs a lot of resources, energy, a lot of focus, a lot of care and attention for us to actually do a breakthrough in terms of working in an intervention. Now, I work mostly by telephone, which speaks to this point whereby there's no real physical stimulus from the practitioner, no visual stimulus. There's no territorial signaling going on with two people in the same room. My approach to sessions minimizes all of these kinds of other flows that can come up when people start getting into very detailed and personal issues. It becomes much easier to work by telephone, because by telephone we don't have there's no physical proximity. Mm-hmm. The only stimulus is the sound, and that for this procedure to work, all we need is the speech signal. So I ultimately settled on producing telephone sessions as the core of that work. And it also allows people to work with me from remote distances. So most of the people who work with me will be out of town, out of region. The convenience of the telephone allows for that.
Yeah, it seems like it can be a real intimate thing if people go and listen to your speech backwards. So since it reveals insecurity and maybe private thoughts that you wouldn't say, right?
The things that you may not even tell your counselor. Because of the ego's role as a sensor, this concept of self-preservation, it comes back, as I was saying earlier, that although the idea of change may seem appealing at first, in the course of doing so, we will discover that we may have different types of attachments to things staying the way they are, even if they're working against us. We are more habituated and maybe even perhaps lazy in some ways to changing our habits. And so to get someone to change their habits, I'm sure you know that that's a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. So speech analysis doesn't force anyone into changing anything. A person would have to, in other words, a person has to come wanting change to begin with. A successful participant has to be at a certain stage in their growth along that path, in their progress along that path, to want to make to leap. To make a cognitive leap towards change. So these are very fine points, but there are questions that come up for individuals who are working in these areas in counseling, these different sort of barometric measurements and qualifiers that help us to understand performance in terms of participant performance and success within the context of a session, and what the practitioner can promise and what are the possibilities. They're very important points. I've tailored my presentations to minimize the number of participants who may not have the stamina to complete a session where we encounter some powerful material. As I said, the shock of the possibility of real change can be very great. And if a person has entered a session without comprehending what possible outcomes, you know, could be there, that person may not have the stamina to complete a session. And so early in my practice, I would run into people going, whoa, I don't want to deal with this, you know? That's enough. And
they,
of course,
came,
it's not a
they came because they just want to find out how they're going to get rich.
and I wasn't encouraging, I wasn't promising that I was going to give people financial advice of any kind. Merely my goal was to find the trauma victims and work with them, the recovering and surviving trauma victims in our society, because the population is vast. The Catholic Church, the YMCA, the Boy Scouts, there are scandals everywhere. It's not hard to find that there's a large community of people who need services. And this offers an opportunity, you know, beyond the abhorrent corruption of medicine and big pharmacies that are pushing for completely different non-solutions. This is a simple, easy to execute procedure. It doesn't take an indefinite amount of time. It doesn't take 7 years of a person's life. You know, they don't have to mortgage their house to enter into sessions. And this is about people taking care of themselves and communities learning to take care of themselves. This is a very advanced procedure, and it is still considered highly controversial. It has no real hallowed place in academia, but it has been exposed and utilized in highly professional organizations who are involved in things like signals intelligence. And it provides an advanced procedure for interrogation. You know, it's not just the psychologists down at Gitmo who are interested in interrogating. Dr. J.L. and Hynek, the federal government's UFO scientist, who mm-hmm. was working on Project Blue Book, commented in his work that he felt in hindsight that Blue Book was a fraud or a cover-up, and that one of the identifying signatures of that was there were no advances in procedures or methodology. There was nothing innovative coming out of the Blue Book work environment. As a scientist, Dr. Hynek was used to innovative people coming up with new approaches to solving problems. And he said, in particular, there was no innovative approach to the interrogation of UFO witnesses. And he recognized that there was a vast gap in working with that material. So at this time now, in the early 21st century, we have a huge legacy of 20th century audio recordings from the UFO contactees, you know, the last 60-odd years. There's a huge legacy of their radio interviews and other recordings that we can utilize for this type of research. And we can exponentially multiply the amount of data, usable information and data that is still retained and encrypted within that repository. So this is a very, very progressive tool. But at the same time, in North America, we've fallen under what could be considered government by secrecy, mm-hmm. or rule by secrecy. And so the perception of, you know, the abstract notion that these types of studies pose some kind of a threat to that kind of, the continuity of that kind of structure, that kind of leadership structure or organizational structure exists as well. So for a person who's practicing this technique in the hope to reach as many people as possible, you know, through media and other venues, so they can do that special work that people can benefit from, the personal one-on-one work or the couple's work, there are a lot of dangers related to whistleblowing and other kinds of questions. You know, not everybody who advances new ideas and knowledge in Western society gets to live the full length of their natural life.
Yeah. So you think is the military using reverse speech for intelligence gathering, perhaps?
Well, anybody who's interested in signals gathering and decoding, you know, and looking for encryption and communication is potentially using this tool. But I'm not party to any of those, you know, organizations. Sure. So I can't speak on their behalf.
So have you heard the clips of Obama's famous "Yes, we can" slogan backwards?
Yo.
Thank you, Satan. So what is that? What is coming through there?
Well, I think there's a mass projection on the part of a heavily, you know, Judeo-Christian influenced society that looks for, you know, biblical type materials in any venue. I mean, the postulation that there's a good God and a bad God to someone like myself, a monist like myself, is ridiculous. So I don't even put any much more energy into exploring what that may or may not mean. It doesn't mean anything to me. And I'm the expert practitioner.
So what do you think about, I know this might just be backmasking, but, you know, in the 60s, a lot of people played music backwards and they heard satanic messages. So what is that?
Well, you know, with the advancement of recording technology, one thing that began to come into production studios is called multi-track recording. So with the availability of 8-track, 16-track, 32-track recording, musicians found these spare tracks could be used for other kinds of novelty experimental materials. And some of those experimental materials included deliberately placed messages that were derived from, you know, intentional recording procedures. So they planted messages in their records for aesthetic, philosophical, religious, commercial reasons. I don't know, but those exist. There is such a thing as backmasking, but that's not what I'm studying. I'm studying organic, naturally emerging everyday human communications and their encryptions, not something that was contrived in a studio.
Sure, got that. Now, is there a difference if someone wanted to do this procedure on their own? Is there a different outcome if you're recording and just talking to yourself versus speaking with another person in your recording and then listening back?
Well, people can study these phenomena using the tools that are available. There's a lot of software tools that people can use on their computers for recording and filtering, and a lot of them have mirror filters. But in terms of outcomes, it's possible under both circumstances that you've described that there could be transmissions. It would depend on the individual and the circumstances. Without any kind of baseline references, it can be difficult to place our discoveries within any kind of a meaningful context. You know, mm-hmm. So when I studied these very controversial issues in society and made public pronouncements about them, I also established baselines that meant that my work could be vetted, and it was heavily vetted over a long period of time. So I created a position where there was at least one practitioner who had a track record for accuracy, that people could use that as a baseline. But people have to establish their own baselines if they want to pursue this. They will have to vet their content and receive feedback about their findings. And that may be best served through a classroom environment where students can work together, meet together as a community, and form community around that to engage in those types of feedback. But in the absence of any baseline measurement, you know, our observations may be meaningless. I think that was what Ingo Swann talked about in his book about remote viewing. Mm-hmm. Ingo Swann, the founder of remote viewing, talked about the need for baselines, that he was not interested in speculative research into subjects that he could never evaluate in his own lifetime. So, you know, as opposed to looking for answers to questions about the dark side of the Andromeda galaxy, where I probably won't be flying by there anytime soon, I won't be able to receive any feedback about any hypothetical claims. So instead of studying subjects like that, I'm focused on studying, as I said, I'm in the clinic working with individuals today with, you know, with real problems today and receiving feedback about my observations. And so that is something, you know, just the, in other words, through practice and through creating circumstances by which I'm called to practice in this field, it's a continuous process of and never ending process of refinement. So a person who wanted to succeed in this would have to consider that as well.
In a past presentation at eSETI, you played a creepy example of reverse speech by, what was her name, Bonnie Blake, who was murdered. Yeah, she taped her phone combos.
Bonnie Lee Bakley.
Oh, Bakley. Okay. Yeah, and you played one of these conversations in reverse, and she said, "I know he'll murder me." So she knew it was coming, and on some level, she had this premonition. It was like a prophetic insight, right?
Yeah, and I thought this was really interesting because this was, I continued to find other materials from individual speakers who were at the edge of death, talking about their deaths before it occurred. And I took note that the unconscious envisions what is to come, whether, you know, favorable or unfavorable. The unconscious is in touch with that. And, you know, just to throw a real twist out there, I mean, what if some local practitioner came up to Bonnie Lee and said, "Hey, I found this message about murder in your speech. Bonnie, you've got to sit down and talk of what's going on." What if someone had intervened on the basis of that discovery and helped somebody?
Yeah.
You see? So, yeah, all these things are possible.
So really, when I hear a lot of these clips too, it seems like deep truths come out, deep unconscious truths. So to me, it seems then that your inner voice cannot lie. It does not lie. It's going to leak out, right?
Well, the truth will always reveal itself eventually is sort of the axiom that most people consider. And this this is one venue via which that can be done, but you have to become an active listener. You know, the messages are encrypted, so you have to get involved in decrypting first before you could, you know, receive that information.
All right. Well, let's play some clips from some of your sessions and you can tell us about it.
Yo. So back in the day when I was working face-to-face with my clients, this individual came to me with a story about her younger brother, a time in her early life when they were both under 5 years old or so, crossing the street holding hands. And her brother, as a young boy, broke free of her grip and ran and was struck by an automobile and lost his life. And so she's describing that story, and I ask her, you know, how did you feel as a consequence of, you know, being in that situation? And she uttered this unconscious phrase that I heard, which said, better hang on to him. I thought that was interesting in light of not only the physical grip, the handhold between the two children, but also in terms of concepts of attachment, because it was the memory of the grief and guilt, shame, et cetera, associated with being party to what had happened, not by not being able to prevent him from dying. It was the attachment itself to the issue that ultimately was what needed to heal.
Okay, here's the clip.
How did that impact on your image of yourself as someone who was responsible, who could take care of other people? You could be trusted with responsibility. What happened?
Well, I don't know how to verbalize it.
There we go. There's better hang on to him.
Yeah, and then Hari, Life is Only a Lesson was a very interesting axiom. That occurred in someone's speech. It was a small business person, and they were talking about business success and failure, ups and downs. And here, the unconscious appears to be imploring them forwards. And again, this idea to not be overly attached to ups and downs, but to move to continuous progress seems to be this be invoked through this message that says, "Hurry, life is only a lesson."
And admitting that something was a failure, and that you lost either money or time or effort and energy. Hurry, life is a winless. Hurry, life is a winless. Hurry, life is a winless.
Wow, that one was really present right there, obvious.
Yeah, isn't it that way that they simply they announce themselves to us, but we have to be there to receive them when they occur, and that requires that patient monitoring, you know, that patient spending time reviewing that material for that to happen. You know, the tree can fall, but you need someone in the forest to hear it.
That's right. So now we have one more here. We have You Only Fear the Memory. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, and actually, this is I heard a little bit of it, and I'm remembering this is a live session, and I think the only significant thing I can say about this is simply that it uses the language of emotion in that it reveals concepts related to fear, and it also shows cognition of past events because it's referring to memory, fear, and memory. So the usefulness, in other words, of this technique in explorations for access to memory and dealing with emotional issues is clearly exemplified by this example of this phenomenon.
You and the fear of the memory. You and the fear of the memory. You and the fear of the memory.
Yep, that one was obvious too.
So this is characteristic of the type of material that can emerge from a session, but it is important to note that it is not simply abstract, dry phenomena with mathematical curves attached to them. These sounds are explicit in their potential to elicit a cathartic response within the listener. It's a very important idea in terms of emotional wellness that people are releasing the pain that they're holding on to emotionally in their emotional bodies in series with hearing these messages and spending time focusing on them. These are very useful tools. And they are, to me, so much like those yogic mantras that liberate our consciousness, because it seems that when people get some relief from their emotional pain, they begin to think more clearly, and they maybe begin to make better decisions, and their behaviors also become more in alignment, even spontaneously, with their innermost nature. I've had people tell me stories where they came out of sessions, and the next day they were in their place of business with a difficult coworker. They had some kind of an encounter with that person, and that they, you know, the pattern of, you know, difficulty began, but the way that the participant responded was completely different, as if they had changed their personality or their synaptic connections had changed as a consequence of the creative work they did under the influence of these sounds. So I have to emphasize that it is so important that not only is the information very intimate and detailed, and not only are the baseline showing us that the grade of information is forensic and military grade, it it really does empower this cathartic process. And catharsis, again, means the release of massive amounts of emotional energy in a very short time, which is an indicator of getting well.
Oh, well done, John. I'll have to play this interview backwards later and see what I can find, huh?
Well, again, the level of intimacy can be shocking. And when CBS Television interviewed me, they put me in a studio with a camera crew and a reporter for 2 hours. The reporter, the camera, and the producer were in the room with me, and they taped me studying the speech of the reporter. And the personal level of detail that emerged from that session was so shocking. When they presented that interview on the air, it was with a straight face. And that was 11 o'clock news on, you know, domestic terrestrial 123 channels television in the United States, because it was simply profound. What's within us, ultimately, what these findings say is that what's within us is profound. And it's that there are deep, deep answers within us. And that for the sake of efficiency, and we should turn within. You know, we should turn within and spend some time exploring these questions. And that could be something we could explore on our own time with our friends, or with a professional who offers these types of services. This is a worthy pursuit, and it's been a great benefit. I've learned a lot. My clients have discovered a lot, and I think we're part of a changing world, where people are looking for new solutions. This is innovative, it's simple, it's accessible, and it relies on something that's widely available, which is human speech.
And you don't need hypnosis or drugs, and it doesn't cost much money.
Yeah, accessibility, simplicity, and the procedure is designed, in my application, the procedure is designed to work with the client's feedback. It's the patient feedback that's the barometer by which we measure progress and success. I give as much trust and responsibility to the patient in terms of, the participant rather, in terms of outcomes. I'm enthusiastic for this process, but I think that people who are serious about counseling and therapeutic work, who are studying consciousness and communications, are more than curious to participate in this area. So there are a lot of information resources. It's been promulgated widely, but in terms of serious practitioners who've picked it up, I'm one of the few.
Have you been practicing this on yourself for a while?
Well, the actual outcome is that because I'm on all of the session recordings with the clients,
mm-hmm.
I hear myself interacting with them while they're working through their most difficult issues. So mm-hmm. I get to see myself and what's coming up from within me while I'm being exposed to that kind of stimulus. And yeah, that's very powerful. As I was saying earlier, that there's a lot of learning that happens for the practitioner, but I think the ultimate lesson is that when people break through the intractable issues that they say have been holding them back for years, that asks us to question, our fundamental assumptions about what our limitations may or may not be as individuals. And so I've been challenged to say, well, gosh, dozens and dozens of people seem to solve this problem with their grandmother. How come I can't fix it? Maybe I could be one of those people too, that. So there's a lot of inspiration and learning that happens in those encounters. People take things away. But I think that, we have to be careful at the same time as in terms of practitioners, in terms of avoiding terms, avoiding dictating the terms of success or progress. My reliance, again, other than these observations of speech, I'm simply interpreting what I heard them say, but it's their feedback during the session that's what's transformative. It's client-led. Again, I'm not then subjecting people to hypnosis and dictating to them terms of what wellness looks like. That's not what I'm doing here at all. Nor am I drawing from any kind of a dream dictionary that gives static definition to a vocabulary of language that may occur in people's backward speech, or giving novel interpretation to existing vocabulary that's already standard to the English language. I'm not trying to tell people that red means blue, for example. So these are very important points, and they characterize my practice, and really they differentiate it from what is taught as reverse speech. For I did study that under its founder. I'm an insider in that organization from its incarnation from the 1990s. So I know exactly what the practice looks like. And my practice is substantially different. I've worked with people who had worked in David Oates' procedure, and they have worked with me. And my practice and my implementation of the protocol is substantially different, and the outcomes are different too. I produce catharsis in one session. You know, the reverse speech methodology required something like 10 sessions and an upfront, you know, commitment of $5,000 to even get started. So that's not what I'm practicing.
Last question for you. Are all the finds accurate? If you speak for 2 hours with someone, are you bound to find something?
Well, it's even simpler than that, because my live demonstrations show that with a 1 minute sample, I can rotate material in 5 minutes and get it verified on the spot by the speaker. And I produce that on television and radio. So it would be impossible to produce those kinds of demonstrations without working with something that was fundamentally reliable.
Got it. How can people reach you for a session?
My website has more information and contact forms. It's yourinnervoice.com. And my toll-free number, which you can call North America-wide, is 1-888-453-0751.
Thank you, John. Very interesting work. I'll have to give it a try, and so should you, the listener. I am going to give this a whirl. In fact, I will reverse this interview and see what comes of it and let all of you know, provided it isn't too embarrassing. I'll leave with a song I've recently discovered by Itel Tech called Deep Pools. We'll talk in the new year 2014, a year I've had many dreams about, but you know how that goes. See you later.